First order, June 29th, 2:05, 3 p.m. Open a work session on Senate Bill, SJR 10. Cletus, can you tell me what
Mr. Chair and Committee, SJR 10 has a dash three amendments for this bill. We replace the content of the bill, deals with private property that shall not be taken for public use nor for particular services of any man. And we have testimony by a panel today to address this amendment.
I'd like to have Senator Starr, Senator Provansky, and Senator Atkinson come up, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for allowing all three of us to come forward on this very important amendment. For the record, my name is Jason Atkinson, and I'm Senator for Southern Oregon. And I'm here today in support of the dash A3s, the dash 3s that are out. I think both of my colleagues here will speak both eloquently on the issue, but I think as you read through, especially lines 11, 12, and 13, telling as a policy of the state of Oregon what is private property, and the private property will not be infringed upon, especially as it's very clearly written out in line 11. That's property is not taken for use by the state, city, county, or other public body if the public body intends to transfer title to the property or to a lesser interest in the property to another private property or private party. I think this is fundamental on several fronts. Both my colleagues will speak eloquently to it, but let me just leave you with one very important book that was written several years ago. It's gone throughout the philanthropy circles, not only in Oregon but also the world. It's called Why Capitalism Works by an Argentine academic. I'm sorry, I've been running Mr. Chair up here. I'm trying to remember his name. Anyway, the principle is why does capitalism work? It's because our system of government and our system of freedom is based upon one thing, which is private property. And when private property is infringed upon, as we've seen, especially with the United States court case at the Supreme Court, certainly you can make an argument that we no longer have that or that is being threatened. So I think what this does is rights the ship for the state of Oregon. And with that, Mr. Chair, I am going to get back to another committee where I have a bill and I'm on a committee. But with my colleagues, thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking time to come.
Thanks, Jason. For the record, I'm State Senator Bruce Starr, representing District 15, Western Washington County, the communities of Hillsborough, Cornelius, North Plains, and Forest Grove. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of the Dash 3 amendments to SJR 10 this afternoon. And Mr. Chair, thank you for your rapid response in scheduling this important resolution. I think, like many of my colleagues, when we heard early Thursday morning that the Supreme Court had ruled in Aquilo versus the City of New London that government can take, basically steal property from one private property owner and give it to another, and based on the Supreme Court, that's legal, available, it's what governments can do. They can use that eminent domain power in that way. I think many of us were shocked. The underlying foundation of what our country is based upon is the right of private property ownership. When I heard that, came to the Capitol, we have 9 o'clock sessions, we have caucus ahead of that, we talked in our caucus, and I think everyone around the table, the 12 of us, were equally just amazed that the United States Supreme Court would make such a ruling. So we endeavored, and I endeavored, to find out, well, what does this mean to Oregonians? What does it mean to Oregon property owners? And what we found is that Oregon's Constitution, has a pretty decent private property rights clause. I mean, it's pretty good. There's a chance that this kind of thing couldn't happen in Oregon. But the chance wasn't enough for us, and that's why you have the Dash 3 in front of you today. I think it's imperative upon us as legislators to make it crystal clear to Oregonians that what private property ownership really means in the state of Oregon. I had the opportunity, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to read I didn't read all of the court document, from the majority at least. I found it a little hard to stomach as I was reading through it, but I did read Justice O'Connor's dissent and Justice Thomas's dissent. And I just wanted to take a couple of quotes, specifically from Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's dissent, that I think encapsulates the issues here that make it, I think, imperative that this legislature take this action before we sign EDI today. The quote that the first quote is, quote, "Today the court abandons this long-held basic limitation on government power. Under the banner of economic development, all private property is now vulnerable to being taken and transferred to another private owner, so long as it might be upgraded, i.e., given to an owner who will use it in a way that the legislature deems more beneficial to the public in the process." End of quote. I think that is puts a pretty clear picture on it. And then I want to read another quote, and then from Justice O'Connor's dissent, and turn the dais over to my colleague, Senator Prozanski. The next quote says that any property may now be taken for the benefit of another private property, but the fallout from this decision will not be random. The beneficiaries are likely to be those citizens with disproportionate influence and power in the political process, including large corporations and development firms. As for the victims, the government now has license to transfer property from those with fewer resources to those with more. The founders cannot have intended this perverse result. Colleagues, I think that it's imperative that we protect all Oregonians' private property rights, whether they're in a well-to-do neighborhood or maybe one that some of us would consider less fortunate or areas that are more economically depressed. I think that all Oregonians should deserve this kind of property protection. I think that's one of the reasons why, when you looked at the court case, you had a broad range of interest groups that partaked on the side that didn't prevail in this case, from the NAACP to, you know, the private property rights groups. I think, Mr. Chair, that this is an issue that isn't partisan. It's not Republican or Democrat. It's not really even conservative or liberal. I think across the board you can find a broad coalition of individuals in this state that understand that the importance of private property rights. I think it's one of these things, one of the issues that this legislature ought to refer to the ballot, and I would expect it would pass handily, and we would add this particular language into the Oregon State Constitution once and for all. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Are you going to be able to stay with us to where the other senators down there?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I also sit here today in support of the Amendment-3 for SJR 10. Now, I've reviewed it. Senator Starr gave it to me on the floor. I reviewed it, and I think it covers my concerns as to making certain that we have the safeguards and boundaries that I think we all would want to make certain. And it really comes into lines 11 through 12, where it talks about that the property that is taken for public use by one of these governmental entities, if the public body intends to transfer the title of that property to a private person or private party, clearly this will not impact the ability for the state or other governmental entity to still use eminent domain for the proper use. But what it will stop, from my reading of this, is where there's an intention to take the property from one private property owner and transferring it to a second property private property owner. The decision that has been referred to, was very surprising to me, as to many people I spoke with in my district, both in the urban and rural areas. It does definitely demonstrate the uniqueness of the type of decision that was given by which side some of the justices were on, but it was a straight 5-4 decision. And so it was one that I think the court really pondered, but I believe the court erred in its decision. And because of that, I think it is important for us to set forth within our own state constitution some of the safeguards that apparently the current U.S. Constitution and the interpretation that the U.S. Supreme Court has given to within its decision may not exist elsewhere.
Committee members, do you have any questions?
Just for the record, unfortunately, I have read the entire thing from front to back. I have it sitting here in front of me. And I just wanted to note in the record that it is a 5-4 decision. However, Justice Kennedy, in fact, wrote a separate concurring opinion, which, in fact, questions whether or not this may go too far. And if you go on to Justice O'Connor's opinion, which raises the issue of it implies the Fifth Amendment has been weakened. And in both cases, in Justice O'Connor and Kennedy's case, they point to the fact that there wasn't a solid state statute or constitutional limit that would prevent it. And of course, to no surprise, Justice Thomas basically says that this null and voids the Fifth Amendment, but that's no surprise there. So, you know, the action I think the committee's been asking to take is to simply reinforce the state statute, the state constitution, to ensure it doesn't happen here. Thank you.
I have a question, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering about whether either senator, whether an amendment to the Oregon Constitution is the best response, or whether a statutory change might be the more appropriate kind of response to the concern. Any reactions to that?
I went directly to the section of the Constitution that you see here as a way to provide constitutional protection for Oregon property owners. I didn't contemplate, honestly, did not contemplate a statutory change. And when I thought of the issue, and I contacted Mr. Honeycutt and asked his ideas, his opinions on what we might do, we in our discussion didn't contemplate a statutory change either.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd just like to say my legislative aide's going to be very happy you brought this forward, because he can stop working on what he's working on regarding the same issue. This will answer that.
Just another statement. I can recall, I think it was when Jefferson was writing the Declaration of Independence, it was life, liberty, and property originally. And then in the second draft, he changed it, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And property was a very highly valued thing as a right that government didn't interfere with as much. And this departure that the court has taken is I think it's being frowned upon by a very broad base of people. As you said, it doesn't matter your political affiliation. We have had some conversation here that we may actually do a piece of legislation quick that puts it in statute, because this wouldn't be almost a year before we'd have the next election in 2006. So. And for the next year, we could be subject to some pretty bad things, but maybe we need to have that conversation.
The other, Mr. Chair, the other idea perhaps would be to draft a ballot title. We could have that discussion as well, whether that makes sense or not. Mr. Honeycutt and Mr. Henricks from Legislative Counselors here, if you have specific questions regarding the language, and they went through several concepts to come to the language that's in front of you today, if you have those kinds of questions.
We're going to call them up in a minute. Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I would, in response to the question that was posed by Representative McPherson, I think you could do it either way. And I know the Chair was looking at maybe statutory fix from our previous conversation earlier this morning. This would, in fact, ensure something I think is a basic fundamental right that would be protected, you know, through the Constitution. The one thing I would want to make certain in my quick review of it is that I believe that it does have the safeguards that eminent domain would not be, quote-unquote, dead in the state, but it would be limited to what I think the true intent is. And I think that having it within the Constitution does, in fact, does not allow for, let's say, another legislature after our time to come in and make a change that may erode some of these general principles. And I think, as the Chair stated, when you look at the foundation, the principles that this country has been founded on, this state's been founded on, it seems to me that it would be appropriate now. This is something that I would suggest to the committee in moving this forward, that we probably should not look at trying to do in a special election. I don't know personally if I would be able to say that we could would justify the expense of putting on that election to put this before the voters. So there may be a need or desire to do something on the short end through a statutory fix.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dave Hennicutt and Mr. Hendricks, please.
You want to go first, Dave?
After you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Hennicutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of the Dash 3s. Senator Starr approached me immediately after the Kelo case. I was, of course, notified of the Kelo case immediately after it was handed down. I got to the office, I believe it was Thursday morning, read through the case, read the concurring opinion and the two dissenting opinions, and was really surprised, as I think most people were, that the court would rule that way. What the court held in the Kelo case, or at least what the majority held, was that the phrase public use in the takings clause of the United States Constitution is essentially the equivalent of public purpose. And so, in other words, in order for a government, a state or local government, or the federal government with condemnation authority, to demonstrate that they are taking property for a public use, that's the key language. The government cannot take property for a private use. They can only take property if they can demonstrate a public use. But in order for them to demonstrate that public use, all they needed to show was that there was some public purpose behind the need to condemn the property, which, in according to the majority in that case, was the equivalent of demonstrating that there was some type of economic benefit to be derived from taking private property from private property holder A and giving it, transferring it to private property owner B. So in essence, in that case, what they were doing is condemning a long-established neighborhood with homes that were well maintained, manicured lawns, well taken care of homes, condemning that property and then transferring it over to a private developer because the Pfizer Corporation, a drug manufacturer, wanted that property and had convinced the city that there would be economic benefits to the city in order to take the property from the homeowners that had held that property for decades and giving it to the drug manufacturer to go ahead and use for some other alternative purpose. That, I think, for regardless of the side of the political spectrum you're on, is troubling, to say the least, simply because it really means that you can't, at least under the U.S. Constitution, expect the courts to protect you when you buy property, to protect you from having that property being subject to the whim, I guess, of a municipality when a neighboring property owner or somebody from out of the area comes in and says to the city council or the mayor or whatever that it would be better off. We could use that property better than Hennicutt could. I can make better economic use of Hennicutt's property than he is, and so why don't you go? But he doesn't want to sell it to me, so why don't you go in and condemn and then transfer it to him? So, Mr. Hendricks and I were, Senator Starr sent a note down to Ledge Council, and Mr. Hendricks and I worked the last couple of days on amendments that I think, one of them I'm sure do exactly what it is that we're trying to do, and that is to prevent private property from being taken from condemned and transferred from private citizen A to private citizen B. The amendments do not limit the ability of the governing body, the condemning authority, to condemn, to use eminent domain for truly public purposes, for a police station or a fire station or a road or the things that we, or a bridge, or the things that we normally consider to be the purposes of eminent domain. But what it does do, or what they do is essentially guarantee that to the property owner that your land will not be taken from you and transferred to another private citizen just because the condemning body decides that the new owner would make a more economic or a better economic use of the property than you would. I would suggest that this go into the Oregon Constitution. Senator Starr and I did not talk about a statutory amendment, but again, this is a fundamental issue, a fundamental right, And I believe that this language belongs with the takings clause that's already in the Oregon Constitution. This is part of the takings clause. It defines public use, and it belongs in the Constitution rather than statutorily. To have a corresponding statutory piece, I think, would be fine. But I think on a right that is as fundamental as this, that it belongs in the Oregon Constitution.
Okay, Mr. Honeycutt. You finished there now?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Hendricks?
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel. I do believe that this is a fairly narrow provision. When we first started talking about this, you know, there was some talk about trying to talk about what a public use is, and that's an extremely difficult thing to determine. It would be more than you'd want to try to do in this constitutional amendment. The approach taken by the language in the proposed amendment here is simply to say that there's at least one thing that is not a public use, and that is where the public body takes the property with the intent to transfer it directly to a private party. I wanted to mention that the language as it currently written is limited to basically public bodies. There are some private bodies that have the power of eminent domain under Oregon law. Public utilities have limited powers of eminent domain. Railroads have powers of eminent domain. I don't think that's probably a problem in this sort of scenario simply because those powers are more limited to the uses that those types of entities make of them. Railroads obviously need easements, et cetera, and we haven't got too many more railroad In fact, I haven't heard of a private condemnation in this state. So I didn't think that was a big issue with respect to the language as far as limiting it to those. The other thing I wanted to mention is that there is a second condemnation provision in the Oregon Constitution. It's in Article 11, Section 4. And it's somewhat strange in that it has very similar language as to the first part of Article 1, Section 18 amended in the proposed amendment, except that it talks about private property should not be taken for public use by corporations. Now, corporations at the time that in Article 11 is used in two different ways. Corporations in the way we think about it now, private companies that have stockholders, et cetera. And it also is used in the sense of municipal corporations. And then there is a 2002 case that indicates that Article 11, Section 4, in fact, applies to both public and private corporations, even though it just talks about corporations. I do not see any need to amend that section or to go near it. Both of those two sections act to serve as a limitation on the ability of government to exercise an inherent power of eminent domain. The constitutional provisions do not create the ability of a public body to condemn property. That existed just by nature of being a public entity. What the Constitution says is, if you do take it, you must provide just compensation. And so this particular provision that we're adding into the Constitution here is an additional restriction, basically, with respect to the exercise of that power. It does not really amend Article 11, Section 4 in the sense that Article 11, Section 4 works fine the way it is. This doesn't change, is it? It still says what it says, which is that corporations, whatever those may be, if they take property, private property for public use, may not do it without giving just compensation. So I just wanted to put that on the record since that other provision is out there, and I'm sure the question would come up is why Article 1, Section 18, when there's this second one that also has this similar sort of provision. I do not think there's any need to go to that and look at that section.
Just one more comment, Mr. Chair. This measure does not, this provision or proposed amendment deals with the takings clause. It doesn't, which needs to be distinguished from the police power. There's nothing in this measure that would prohibit a municipality from condemning property for some type of nuisance abatement. That is an exercise of the police power, and the U.S., both the U.S. and the Oregon Supreme Courts have been clear that action in enforcement of the police power is quite different from action from eminent domain under the takings clause. And so in case somebody makes that argument, and I haven't heard that argument being made, but it was addressed both in the Kelo opinion and also in the Mugler case, that late 1800s case from the United States Supreme Court, and also in the Oregon Supreme Court. I can't provide you the Oregon Supreme Court side, but I've run out of that opinion a number of occasions.
Committee members, do you have any questions?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. First question for Mr. Honeycutt. Is this in response to any problems that have been identified in Oregon? Are there cases where property is being taken under the power of eminent domain and then turned over to private parties here in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, yes, we actually I can think of two occasions. One in the city of Kaiser, we had clients in the city of Kaiser by the name of Lowry who owned a nursery. The nursery sat on land that was part of the Kaiser Station project, a large retail commercial development, proposed commercial development. And our clients Mr. Lowry had lived on the property for decades and didn't want to sell. The developer, before they completed the project, failed to get any type of option or agreement to purchase from the Lowrys, then came in and realized that the Lowrys weren't really interested in selling their property for what was under the master plan, a Krispy Kreme donut shop and a parking lot. And the developer then went to the city of Kaiser and asked the city of Kaiser to consider the initiation of condemnation proceedings to take our client's property. The city took the initial steps, never made a formal offer to our client, but had discussed and were ready to initiate those steps to condemn. We got involved, sent a memo to the city of Kaiser indicating that we would litigate this issue if we had to, and the party and cooler heads prevailed at that point. Negotiations ensued, and the property was ultimately, an agreement was ultimately reached between the developer and the Lowrys. But of course, the Lowrys, that agreement was somewhat tainted, at least from our perspective, by the Lowrys' fear that if they didn't make an agreement, their property was ultimately going to be condemned and they'd be involved in litigation over whether or not the existing provisions of the Oregon Constitution provided them with that protection. The second case, and one that we're not involved in, one I just read just the other day in the Statesman Journal, also involves the city of Kaiser and that same project. So apparently that's a fairly contentious project with the developers. But those are two that I'm aware of off the top of my head are immediately popped ahead.
Oh, if I might, Mr. Chair?
So I'm
assuming that even under the existing constitutional language, there's the issue, there's the phrase, shall not be taken for public use. And I'm assuming that the position you would have taken in that litigation if it had gone forward is that a Krispy Kreme donut shop wasn't a public use, and so there was no right to take the property even under the existing language.
Mr. Chair, right? Representative McPherson, that's exactly right, but I would remind you that the public use language also appears in the U.S. Constitution. The private property shall not be taken for public use is the language out of the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and again, the U.S. Supreme Court just last week said public use means really doesn't mean public use. It means public purpose. And we will defer to a local government's interpretation, provided they have detailed findings, I think was Justice Kennedy's concurrence, to demonstrate what a public purpose is. And if that means that we can take from property owner A and give to property owner B, who will generate some type of higher economic use of that property, that's good enough for us. They've essentially, and I think Justice O'Connor is right in her dissenting opinion, they have essentially eviscerated the public use language of the U.S. Constitution. If they can do that at the U.S. Supreme Court, there's no reason why the Oregon Supreme Court couldn't do that under the Oregon Takings Clause.
Further question, Mr. Chair? This is a quick, for Mr. Hendricks. The proposed additional language focuses on the title to the property as opposed to the use of the property. And I'm wondering whether this could get us into difficulty in uses that are, everybody would recognize are public, but the title not being held in the public body. And I don't know that that's an issue. I just don't know enough about how, you know, fairly complex projects are put together that involve a combination at times of public uses and private uses, and there's some fairly imaginative kinds of projects that kind of have mixed use sorts of elements to them that will include significant public occupancy. And I'm just wondering if you had those kinds of projects in mind, or at least to avoid having an undue impact on those kinds of projects in crafting this language.
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, I did not. I have worked a lot with the work groups of the Oregon Law Commission for the condemnation bills that have been coming through here for the last two sessions, and it's kind of a small club of people who do condemnation work. I've been amazed. The same folks usually are involved every time there's a question relating to condemnation. I can't imagine that there would be some projects out there where the thought was to do sort of a mixed arrangement, although for most large buildings and developments, my impression has been that, for instance, if property is condemned for purposes of building a jail or something, but there's going to be retail space, usually that's leased arrangements rather than title. And it's not really a transfer of an interest, it's a leasehold interest. I don't know how many of those, I don't know if there's that many out there. I'm trying to think of some offhand where there has been a condemnation of property by a public body with the idea that it would be a mixed-use type of arrangement. I'm just trying to think, and some of these other practitioners do a lot, might be able to have something on their tips of their tongue, but I'm not aware of any.
Follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chair. Your comment about leasehold interests kind of sparked a thought. And I'm not a real estate lawyer at all, but I thought that a leasehold interest was an interest in real estate. That is, it's a form of ownership in real property. And I'm wondering whether the phrase "or a lesser interest in the property" might be construed to include leasehold interests. Mm-hmm. At least, it would. As a non-real estate lawyer, it would strike me that it might well. And so I'm wondering if, just kind of spin this out, you know, if when you go into a lot of buildings that are clearly public buildings, there'll be particularly in if you look in downtown Portland, there's an effort in urban design to try to have engaging street level kinds of presentation in larger buildings, including leasing space for regular commercial operations, restaurants and tobacco shops and whatever within a public building. And I'm wondering whether this language would mean that a building where property was taken by eminent domain to do a public building, whether that would prevent any of that space from being leased to a private leasehold holder.
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, I don't know if there's very, probably, I don't know too many situations where entire buildings have been taken by eminent domain. We're almost, I think, almost always talking about land with the idea that it's going to be used for a different use. And, you know, I think your question's good. And, you know, even as I was saying leasehold interest, I was thinking, kind of thinking through that as well. But, you know, the interesting thing there is that usually what happens is a building gets put up, and then they lease space on the building, and which isn't really the underlying land per se. It's space in the building, as opposed to if they wanted to lease a portion of the real property of the land itself. It's a good question. I think it definitely bears thinking through and looking at and seeing if there's some way to talk about lesser interests that would work better.
Okay, and what I think is one final question, Mr. Chair, and this is also for Mr. Hendricks. It strikes me that there's a double negative in the language here that, in fact, I was a little confused by it when I just first glanced at this amendment. And I have to confess, it's my first looking at it when I walked into the committee room today. But the Section 18 existing language starts out, property shall not be taken for public use, nor, et cetera, without just compensation. And then the additional language is property is not taken for public use if it intends to transfer title, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a prohibition on taking property for public use without paying just compensation. And then it's a negative statement about what it means to be taking property for transfer to a private party. And on a first scanning, I found myself confused by that double negative aspect to it, and I suspect if this were, you know, appended to a ballot title, the public might have the same reaction to it, the voters, if they were presented with this. What are your thoughts on that?
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, we finished this up last night at a certain point, and as I was sitting in the room reading it today, you know, being a scribbler, I tend to rewrite everything 10 minutes after I wrote it, too. And I don't know, I'll throw it out. Dave here may have issues with it. I wonder if the sentence wouldn't work better as simply a straight statement that the state, a city, a county, or other public body may not take private property by eminent domain under the power of eminent domain if they intend to transfer. I mean, the reason we got here is because we started from the case.
Yeah.
And looking at what they were saying, what constituted a public use.
Right.
And plus, the Constitution currently doesn't talk about eminent domain or condemnation. It's, as I said, that was an inherent power with these provisions basically acting as a restriction on that power, saying, well, we're not reducing your power to take it, but if you do, you have to give just compensation. But it might be that this is the time to bring it in just to get a straight statement about when you can exercise the power of eminent domain.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dave, just to having to face this with your scribblers already, there is a difference between may and shall, is there not? And may not be, as is not. May is more permissive and shall is not permissive. But my only concern in this is to ensure that it is not a permissive word, it is in fact a directive word.
Chair Krieger, Vice Chair Boquist, the may not would be the best one. May not is basically eliminating any discretion that the public body would have, and that has been our usual use that we have been trying to use more and more. Shall not has a wonderful ring from the Ten Commandments, but from a purely grammatical point of view, is one of those constructions when you look at it that it actually looks like it's more predictive. You know, that the person shall not do this. Well, maybe they will, maybe they won't. May not has been used by our office for a long time now, basically to negate any authority to engage in activity.
Well. I have to say that my style of drafting departs from legislative council style on that point rather fundamentally, and so I yield to their their preferences.
One quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure it's in the record if we're going to do this, that page 9 of the actual court opinion, which I believe is written by Stevens correctly, does point out in the opinion that the reason this was allowed to happen in the Supreme Court is the state constitution allowed it to happen. And then page 19 of the majority opinion clearly sends, and I'll quote into the record, "We emphasize that nothing in our opinion precludes any state from placing further restrictions on the exercise of the taking powers," which is, of course, what we're trying to do now, is to prevent having this happen in the state of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Can close the public hearing on SJR 10. And Senator Starr, maybe Provansky, could you meet with Representative Boquist and look at some more wording? There's a couple little things I think we need to address, please.
And just for the record, we want Mr. Hendricks there, too.
Well, he might be of some value.
Just for a second, what I want you to do is just open the session.
Okay, here.
If you want, I'll be back in just a
minute. Okay.
10 minutes. What? 10 minutes.
Okay, here, real quick, right. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 424, and I think, Joe, that's yours.
Yes. Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Senate Bill 424A is the bill that comes to you from the Senate Rules Committee. We heard testimony on June 27th from the proponents of the bill. This is the measure that would amend the statute that currently requires the court, when granting a FAPA restraining order, to award temporary custody of the children to the petitioner. And what this bill would do would allow the court to hold a hearing if exceptional circumstances affecting the children's safety or welfare required additional information, and it would give the court limited, albeit discretion, to find circumstances where the children's safety required a grant of custody, a temporary grant of custody of the children to the respondent as opposed to the petitioner of a restraining order. We heard testimony from Sybil Hebb of the Oregon Law Center, Melissa Seidlick of the Oregon Judicial Department, and the Honorable Dale Koch, the presiding judge of Multnomah County, all in support of this measure, and there are no amendments before you.
Do we have any questions of Joe regarding this? If there are no questions, do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 424 to the floor with the due pass.
We have a motion to move Senate Bill 424 to the floor with the due pass. Any discussion? Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Unanimous decision, or a unanimous vote, 424 will go to the floor with a due pass. And do we have a carrier?
Representative McPherson, would you carry it?
Sure. Delighted. Representative McPherson will carry it. That will close 424.
I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1047A.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1047A comes to you from the Rules Committee. There was a public hearing before this committee on June 27th. This is the bill that would provide the local public safety coordinating councils the authority to form multidisciplinary teams to review domestic violence fatalities in their jurisdictions and make recommendations to prevent such fatalities in the future. We discussed the confidentiality provisions of the bill, the exemption to the public meetings laws, we also heard testimony from Sybil Hebb of the Oregon Law Center, Connie Gallagher of the Oregon Department of Justice, and the Honorable Dale Koch, the presiding judge of Multnomah County, all in favor of the bill. There are no amendments before you.
Okay. Have a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1047A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker has moved Senate Bill 1047A to the floor with a due pass. Any objections, questions? Call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1047A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Barker, would you carry the bill?
I would, sir.
Close. Open a work session on Senate Bill 591.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 591, it comes to you from Senator Floyd Prozonsky. This is the bill that would clarify that a driver is not liable for a traffic violation for failing to stop for a pedestrian where the pedestrian is in the bicycle lane or the part of the roadway where the vehicle stops, stands, or parks. We heard testimony on this bill on the 27th of June from Senator Prozonsky. At that time, Chair Krieger directed Senator Prozonsky to work with Mark Landauer of the City of Portland to work out any possible changes that were needed to the bill, and the information I have from the parties is that they agree that no further changes were required. There are no amendments before you to the bill.
Okay. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 591 to the floor with a due pass.
Bill 591 to the floor with a due pass. Any further discussion? Objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 591 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I carried this. The bill was amending last session. So if unless somebody else would like to, I would kind of like to carry this.
Would
bill
you like to carry it?
I would.
And we'll love to give it to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So
we love volunteers, kind of like the Army. Okay, we'll open a work session of Senate Bill 1059A.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1059A comes to you from Governor Kulongoski. This is the bill that we heard testimony on June 23rd. The bill would give the Department of Human Services the statutory authority to place youths who have been found guilty except for insanity or who have been found mentally incompetent to stand trial in intensive community inpatient facilities as opposed to placement in the Oregon State Hospital as is required under current law. The testimony we heard on the 23rd was from Bill Bushka of the Department of Human Services Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. The information at that time was that the Oregon State Hospital had closed the ward, the only ward that was available to house youths in these circumstances, and that there was a secure intensive community inpatient facility that is now available to place youths when they come along, but the need for statutory authority is the reason for this bill. There is an amendment before you that was before you also on the 23rd but was not moved on at that time. It is the A4 amendment, and the A4 amendment is purely a conflict amendment with Senate Bill 39A, which has already passed both chambers, and I should have rechecked this. At the time, on the 23rd, it had not yet been signed by the governor. It may very well have been by now. In any case, 39A amends the same section of the statute with respect to a slightly different issue. It requires the court to actually state on the record the mental illness that it finds is the basis for a person's guilty except for insanity plea. And it also requires the court to order a psychological evaluation if the court is going to commit the individual to the Psychiatric Security Review Board if no psychological evaluation was previously submitted to the court. So this A4 simply makes conforming changes consistent with Senate Bill 39A, which is on the way to becoming law, if not already.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A4 amendments to Senate Bill 1059.
Representative Boquist has moved the A4 amendments into Senate Bill 1059. Any discussion?
So ordered.
Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 1059 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1059 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any objections, questions? Call the roll, please.
Representative Rucker?
Aye.
Representative
Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1059A moves the floor as amended with a due pass. Representative Barker, would you carry that, please?
Yes, sir.
Open work session on Senate Bill 955A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 955A is one that comes from the Committee on Judiciary. You had a hearing on June 23rd. It is a bill, very briefly, that deals with the condominium and planned communities and require that they have that their 30-year plan that includes for maintenance, repair, and replacement of common elements of the association, and that be appropriate for the size and complexity of the property and elements within it. There are no amendments that have been given, and it had come out of the Senate 28-2.
Okay, have a motion on the bill.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 955 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 955A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 955A moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative McPherson, would you carry it, please?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair.
Close the work session on 9:55, and we have completed our work for the day. We're adjourned.
Representative Barker, it took us 20 extra seconds.
Yep, you did a good job.